If you've ever watched an episode of Gordon Ramsay's Hell's Kitchen, you'll recall that one station is the garnish station. Now, in that kitchen, garnishes mean all the vegetables and the starches for each plate. That's probably an evolution from the original classic version, and that was made for need and for speed. What was left behind is some labor and nothing short of a dish unto itself in some cases. This is the next in more of the Escoffier series, and today it's garnishes. The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 188.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, folks. Dan Reed here, the Culinary Libertarian. Welcome back to the podcast. Happy to have you here. Happy to be here. So, as I mentioned, today's episode is garnishes, and garnishes in Escoffier's kitchen were some work. And I'm going to find a couple and read through one for sure. It's an extreme version, but it kind of proves the point. But also, there is a whole section in the garnishes category. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what he means. When we think of garnish on that classic sandwich, the hot dog, the garnish is the mayo, the mustard, the relish, the onions, the dried onions, the pickles, if you're in Chicago, the tomato slices. Heck, you could put hard-cooked egg and sauerkraut on there. On a main course, say you have a beef stroganoff, the garnish is the little pearl onions and the mushrooms. So anything that is a supplement to the main thing is a garnish. Well, back in the Escoffier's time, I remember mostly service was done from trays to the plate in front of the guest, French service, sometimes Russian service, that's a whole other conversation. And so everything was compartmentalized. So there is an entire category which I'm going to mention and then save for a whole other episode, which is called forcemeats. It is an unattractive word, but it is the whole category of mousses, which is mousses and mousselines are not the same, and the terms get misused frequently and commonly, although they're wrong. Another, that's for the other pâté episodes. But the other forcemeats would be things in the realm of pâtés, which is then also a skill pretty much the same as making a sausage. And then there's different, he also lists different kinds of things called the panade. And the panade is a binding agent for the forcemeat you're going to make. And I've probably done more harm than good by mentioning it at all, but these things are there. So let me see if I can make this kind of quick, because I don't want to dwell on it too very much. Into your forcemeat. Now, part of what they means is you're forcing fat or other stuff into the meat. In some cases, it is the panade, which is going to hold all of these things. It can be bread, it can be flour, it can be made from frangipane, which is kind of fun. It can be made from rice, it can be made from potatoes. But in any of these cases, you are taking this thing, and let's find, so let me go back, we're going to move back. So fine forcemeat with cream, known as mousseline forcemeat. So we're taking fresh fresh flesh, white trimmed, free from sinew. Generally, that would be chicken. Then it could also have been pork. It could be turkey. Probably wouldn't have been turkey, but it could be turkey. Egg whites, fresh cream, and this is what people call mousse, but this is what really is a mousseline. Nowadays, you would take that white meat free of sinew and put it into a food processor, and then pretty much make a puree out of that into the food processor, add the egg whites, blend that in, and then add cream in portions. The culinary schools will tell you to add the cream in small quantities and pulse it in, turn it on, turn the machine off and on, off and on, off and on. In lots of kitchens, you'll see cooks just sort of pour it in like they're adding cream into their coffee, and that can work. The culinary school's objection will be that by adding the cream at a steady stream into the high speed of the food processor, you risk turning the cream into butter. Well, it seems in all the years I've made mousselines, a rare to almost impossible probability, but it remains at least statistically possible. And that's a minor distinction only in procedure. What you end up with is this meat that has egg whites, added protein, and then fat, and then water, because cream is up to 40% fat, which means it's 60% water and other stuff. Then from that, you can add things to it. You can add truffles, or morels, or blanched asparagus tips, or fiddlehead ferns, or pearl onions, or cooked mushrooms, at that point, the sky is the limit. Place it into either boring or fanciful molds, and fanciful molds would have a decoration on the outside, so when you tip it out, you have this visual texture. In some cases, you could put decorations into those things. Think about like grandma's Jell-O molds, where she would put pistachios or cherries or something into those points. So when it tips out, it's like, woo, it's pretty. Well, it kind of is pretty. So it's not really, it sounds weird, but it's kind of the same idea. So instead of using Jell-O, we're using meat. All right, so all those other kinds of possibilities, and then all different kinds of meats and different kinds of additions inside. You can also use organs, offal meats. Well, not you, but, Escoffier. So let's go back to the beginning. I want to read his introduction, and just because I think it's interesting to think that we're going to just round to 200 years and say that that's probably close, and I think that makes more of the point. So he writes, and the point is that there's some interesting language then about what he says, and certainly it applies nowadays to cooking, at least in my opinion. Quote, "In the work of the kitchen, garnishes have an importance and play a role which no practicing cook can afford to misunderstand. Their composition should always be in direct keeping with the item or piece that they will accompany. All fanciful, outlandish ideas should be rigorously avoided. According to the need, and above all, to the nature of the item that they will accompany, garnishes are prepared from vegetables, farinaceous products, various molded forcemeats, quenelles of different sizes and shapes, coxcombs and kidneys, all types of mushrooms, olives, truffles, mollusks and crustaceans, and sometimes eggs, small fish, and certain meat products. In other cases, garnishes can be the result of a flavoring of dishes that they accompany, as in the matelotes, in compotes, and in preparations of dishes a la bourguignon, etc. Vegetables destined for use as a garnish are shaped and prepared according to the role assigned to them in the dish, but in some cases they are cooked in their own particular way as an ordinary vegetable. This also applies to farinaceous products, mollusks, and crustaceans. This chapter includes only the items for each garnish and their proportions, leaving to each particular chapter details of their preparation, end quote. So, that's a lot of stuff for garnish. That's pretty much everything that isn't the main course, which is kind of the idea. Farinaceous products, that's seldom used today. Think rice and grains and noodles. And he likes the word noodles. So we've covered the fact that we're not going to cover force meats. What I wanted to just bring up as a way of illustrating just how hard some of this would be. So think about being in a... Where did it go? Think about being in a French kitchen, in a brigade system, and then you probably hear the pages turning. Somehow I've misplaced my page. So while I'm looking for it, let's go back to Gordon Ramsay's Hell's Kitchen. His pretty famous dish is the beef Wellington. Now, beef Wellington is a challenging dish on a whole variety of levels to accomplish, but when done well, it is spectacularly worth eating. So the main thing is, of course, inside is beef. Outside is a thing called duxelle. Duxelle is a garnish. It's made from mushrooms, finely chopped mushrooms, and you cook them until they turn dry, and it can be done from any kind of mushroom. And for those of you resisting and balking and eating mad and saying, no, well, yes, because we can use any mushroom we want, and we even have permission from Escoffier to do that. Not that we need permission, but we can. So it's cooked really dry, because mushrooms have a lot of water. We take all the water out, and what is left behind is flavor. So a little bit of shallot in there in the beginning for some of that sweet onion flavor, some black pepper. Some recipes have been known to sort of deglaze with a port or a sherry or a red wine, depending on the final use, that might be okay. If you're doing a duxelle on a beef Wellington and it's got a really rich red wine sauce, then red wine as an element into that duxelle would make sense. All right, so I did find what I was looking for as an example with rice. And so if for some of the cases here, you would make a border on the tray intended to serve out of rice. And so we're just going to read through this. This is why it's not done. Preparation for bases and cases, holding things, made from rice. Wash 4.5 pounds of Patna rice under running cold water until the water is clear and shows no traces of starch. Blanch the rice for 5 minutes in plenty of boiling water, then refresh until cold. Drain well and rewash the rice in hot water. Drain again, then place in a large pan lined with a clean, strong cloth or with slices of pork fat. Add 1/3 ounce alum and cover the rice with another cloth or salt pork fat. Cover with a lid and cook in a slow oven for 3 hours. Remove the rice and pound vigorously in a mortar, then place it in a cloth which has been well smeared with lard and knead it well. Place the mixture into molds which have been greased with lard and allow to cool. When it is very cold, the rice can be cut into required shapes. They can then be kept for a long time by keeping in fresh water with the addition of alum, changing it frequently. Do you see that happening at your local Applebee's? I don't. I don't see that happening at Le Cirque. If they're even still open, they're probably not. They probably closed 30 years ago. The point is, no one's doing that. No one's doing that with noodles or with vegetables. It's just not going to happen. So, what's the point of bringing up garnishes? Well, the point of bringing up garnishes is that there are things that we still use, like the duxelle, like a mirepoix, which we use mostly in the first stages of sauces and stocks. But there is also the cold applications for these mousselines. Again, we're going to get into that. By the way, just probably not going to be mentioned more because it's really hard to do. It's almost, it's except for food shows, I think it isn't done anywhere, and that is aspics and chauffeur. Well, let me step back a minute and say that our food historian friend Ken Albala is working on a book on aspics, as he spent a lot of time putting all manner of things in all manner of gelatin things. Now, I don't know that technically he made aspic, because aspic is made from clarified beef meat products, but I'm gonna give Ken a lot of leeway because he did use gelatin, but he I've seen the pictures on his webpage, on his Facebook page, and there's some really amazing stuff. So at some point he should have that book coming out, and it's fascinating. It ain't your college jello shots, I can tell you that. Chauffeur is a it looks white. It's poured onto silver trays, and then it's gelatinous. It's edible, but I don't think anybody really eats it. And then it is like a canvas, in that you apply decoration to it and then pour aspic on top of it, clear aspic. So you have this white oval on a silver tray, and then you would take blanched leek greens or blanched chives, blanched slices of carrot, and then use little delicate cutters to cut little teardrop shapes out. And then with tweezers, carefully place your blanched teardrop cutouts of carrots in a circular pattern with a blanched piece of skin of yellow squash or something, and then a chive coming down. So you're making what's appearing to be a vegetable flour. And it becomes very ornate, and it can be extremely intricate. And then on top of that, the cook will pour some aspic so that all of it stays. And then in the white space, the presentation of the thing, either quenelles of something, or you've got mushroom caps filled with something, or slices of pate or terrine. There's all kinds of ways and all kinds of things to present on that. It is extraordinarily time consuming, and that's, first of all, the main reason no one does it, is because it takes an immense amount of time. But pretty. He does have a little bit more to say on garnishes. I'm going to read this paragraph or three. Quote, "The principles underlying the composition of garnishes, as in all other culinary preparations, is intangible. Where in certain cases modifications are found to be necessary, they only imply a difference in arrangement and shape according to the requirements of the dish, and do not indicate a change in the item of the garnish. Also, the same garnish applied on the one hand to a large joint, such as fillet of beef, and on the other hand a preparation such as tournedos, should necessarily undergo a modification in its size, shape, and arrangement, so that the garnish is in keeping with either. These observations hold good for small cuts from the fillet and chateaubriands where logic may indicate something else. In consequence, The proportions of the following garnishes have been established for service of 10 covers, and they will require altering in terms of size and quantity according to the kinds of garnish being prepared and its ultimate use, that is, whether they are for large joint or for smaller items. End quote. Actually, I'm going to continue a little bit more because I find this interesting, and it goes back to my think about the time difference here. Quote, at this point, it is necessary to consider a matter of great importance, taking into account that this book, being a collection of traditional French culinary techniques, it necessarily includes a number of garnishes, the composition of which is no longer in keeping with modern practice, which requires the avoidance of complications and the need to simplify the garnish in such a way as to ensure a rapid and consequently perfect service. The dishes cannot be eaten in all their perfection unless they are served very hot, and this cannot be done unless the garnish is kept very simple, lending themselves to quick arrangements on the dish. Now, with that in mind, and bear in mind that the border things like the rice I just read is done well ahead of time and kept for later, but there was one which I thought in no way was it going to be, well, shoot, wouldn't you know? I didn't mark it. I should have marked it. Anyway, it's just, it's obscenely long. And part of, well, it's just, it's long, and in the it's a lot of math and do this and that. And so here's one. This is garnish a la Normandy for fish. 10 each of poached and bearded oysters and mussels, 10 small button mushrooms, 100 grams or 3.5 ounces of shelled prawns, 10 slices of truffle, 10 medium-sized truss crayfish cooked in corbillon, 10 gudgeons or small smelts, pommard and manchon, 10 small diamond-shaped croutons of bread fried in butter, and it's just, this is expected. I mean, you can have the oysters shucked, I suppose. You could have the mussels cleaned, I suppose. You could have the some of the stuff ready to go, but this is intended to be done mostly at service, so it's hot. It's like, well, again, this isn't going to happen. So, what is the point of all this stuff to garnish? Well, compatibility. Something that is appropriate for the dish. And so the point, and now if you like it and it tastes good and the people who eat it say this is the best thing I've ever had, then really that's the thing that matters. But for compatibility of like things. So a salad made from, oh, let's just be kind of silly. So you've got delicate pansies and violets outside, and you want to make a nice little lightly dressed salad with a just the barest of rice vinegar and a I wouldn't recommend it, but a grapeseed oil, something very light, and some lavender flowers, just a bunch of delicate things. You wouldn't put a salad like that with a big old hunk of grilled Delmonico. The char marks and the strong beef fat flavor would completely destroy the delicate flavors and the nuances of a salad so delicate. So there's a compatibility necessity so that the garnish actually stands a chance with the course it's intended to be eaten with. So that's part of it. Size compatibility, so you don't want your garnish, if you're serving little 4-ounce grilled 200 doses of beef, you don't want this, you know, you're not going to do a jackfruit. Here's your garnish. That's absurd, but I'm making a visual point that that thing is huge. It's like a freaking boulder. So compatibility matters. Flavor compatibility, size compatibility. Now, we can also get into, this is where flavor can change, and we can go with contrast. Temperature contrast is one way to go. So you could do, this is interesting, and this was actually a big seller at a restaurant many years ago, a cold salad, tossed greens, like a mescaline salad, and put that on the plate, and then all your, like, roasted red bell pepper, it's going to work in this case, maybe pickled pearl onions, maybe pickled cauliflower, then nice mashed potatoes on top of that in the middle, and then on top of that, a hot grilled portobello mushroom. So the contrast of cold lettuce crunching with a nice, strong balsamic vinaigrette, and that acid and cold going with the rich, hot, fatty potatoes and that steak-like portobello mushroom, well, we have a lot going on there, and it actually works. It's like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. Serve it with a couple of nice crostinis, big fat croutons. Well, that's good stuff. All right. You can, at your leisure, probably find this online just to go through and see. There's 131 basic garnish recipe procedures. I don't know that I call them recipes, but they're procedures. Some of them are really complicated. Some of them aren't. Some of them are really good ideas. Some of them aren't because they're just hard to find.
Find guests for your podcast or find a podcast to be a guest on with Podmatch. I've used Podmatch multiple times and have found great guests. Use my link, culinarylibertarian.com/podmatch, to find your perfect podcast match.
So let's move in to basics of soup. Let's get into, I think, just kind of cover the classifications and start with that and then see how it goes. So he does this. So soups is chapter 3. And he has a comment here in his general observations. He writes, quote, soups in the old classical kitchen were in fact complete dishes in themselves and contained, apart from liquid content and its vegetable garnish, a wide variety of meat, poultry, game, and fish, end quote. Now, we're going to talk at some point about soups that have no part of any of that stuff. And he's taking this idea and saying, in the olden times, this is how it was. His classifications of soups start with simply this. Clear soups, I'm looking, because there's a lot of clear soups. Let me get into more garnishes for the soups, which is a whole other ballgame. Puree soups, velouté soups, cream soups, and then more puree soups, and then it gets, and then we get into specialty, or specialty would be kind of like regional to country, like mulligatawny, would not be French, but it's good soup. All right, so now let's break some of this down, even with all the page turning. So, first soup, clear soup. What does a clear soup mean? Well, the king mac daddy of clear soups is consommé. All right. Consommé I've talked about at some point. I guess it needs to be made, but it's worth doing. But it is labor intensive. As quickly as I can. So what you're doing with the consommé is you're at least two things are happening. You're enriching the stock with a tremendous amount of flavor and also removing every little teeny tiny bit of stuff that would get in the way of making this soup as clear as water. Now, there is an important distinction to be made right now that a beef consommé can be as clear as water, but it is brown, brown, brown. It's not quite as dark as a cup of coffee, but it certainly can be as dark as a very potent cup of tea. The other thing consommés end up being is very highly gelatinous due to the nature of how they're made. How they're made is you have a well-made stock to begin with, and well-made in this case means that it wasn't allowed to boil longer than necessary, and necessary is about a minute, and then you turn it down because boiling will cloud the stock, and in some cases you can't uncloud it even with a consommé. So this well-made, rich, gelatinous stock will then have added to it more meat. I'm gonna guess a pound of meat per gallon, and some recipes will double that. And then a variety of vegetables, certainly carrots, celery, onions. I would add parsnips. I would add leeks. I would add fennel. If you're making a if you're making a dark stock, I'd roast them, but then I'm taking that back. I'm not roasting those at all because I don't want the oil in there. Because one of the other characteristics of a consommé is they are completely fat-free. That's hard. So in the grinder, grind this meat, grind your veggies. We want small. The more surface area we can get from our vegetables, the more flavor and color we're going to get out of it. And then aromatics, everything would go in at the beginning here, different than we do with stock. And then the one last thing that's added, and this is the part that's really strange, but this does the job of clarifying meaning removing all the stuff of the stock, and that is egg whites. So take regular egg whites, whip them a little bit just so they are, so you break them up a little bit. Add all that into the cold mix of ground meat and veggies and slop all this stuff around. It's going to look like really, really loosey-goosey meatloaf mix. And that goes into the cold stock. Give it a good stir so that all that stuff is separated. And then give it some heat. And in the process of that stock getting hot, the consommé, this goo, is going to end up being called the raft because it will float, and as the stock sort of percolates up through, we're going to put a hole in the raft, and sometimes the raft will sort of form one by itself, and then you just sort of help it make that hole. It doesn't have to be in the center, but we need a hole in that raft somewhere, so that the stock can percolate up over it and then wash back through. And as it's washing back through that raft of meat and veg, it's taking flavor with it, leaving behind bits of stuff. Now, we've already added a whole bunch of bits of stuff in here, but conveniently, the raft, as the heat increases, the egg whites begin to coagulate, and they hold all of this stuff together. And it may take a couple of hours of cooking, nice, slow, rolling simmer for the flavor to be extracted from the stuff in the raft and for the reduction of the stock to reach a richness and a gelatinousness that we like. So that's making consommé. The trick now is getting it out. Now, in restaurants that make lots of consommé at a time, like, say, 10 gallons at a time, they make a pot that has a spigot on the bottom, which is quite handy. So you just open the spigot and then watch out, and, of course, catch it in something that can hold 5 to 10 gallons of hot liquid. Put it through a fine, we call it a chinois. It's a very, very tightly woven screen to catch all the little bits in case, in case something didn't go through. You can also strain it through a couple layers of wet cheesecloth, even coffee. I've done it through coffee filters too. That takes a long time, but it gets every last bit. So, as a verbal description, that's mostly what counts to me. It doesn't really do a whole lot without seeing it, but maybe I'll make a stock and maybe we'll do a consomme, because that would be a spectacular Patreon bonus content episode. All right. King of all soups, well, maybe entirely, is the consomme, because it takes a lot of work. Done well, the flavor is just a knockout punch. A lot of boxing metaphors. A knockout punch of flavor, and it's spectacular. And there are pages and pages of garnishes for consommes. Now, again, one of the really key things that a consomme is not fat. No fat on top. The easiest way to do that is make a consomme today, chill it. When the fat hardens on top, lift all of it off. Ta-da! Fat-free. Very simple. So then we get into, now, there's a lot of different ways people take this information, and there's a specialty soup in here called a potage garber. It sounds like a fancy word to say garbage soup, and quite honestly, if you read the ingredients, that's kind of what it looks like, except they're pretty good. And I worked with a guy who... He got so mad insisting no such thing existed. I mean, he got red in the face. He got angry. He got really, really angry when I put potage garber on the menu. It was an unhealthy kind of anger. So in the puree soups sort of sounds obvious. You sweat your parsnips and fennel and leek whites in some butter. Add some not roasted, some white chicken stock, or you could add fish stock to this and add some cream. Let that come to a boil. Put that into a blender and puree it all. Strain it, put it back on the stove. Bring it back to a simmer because we don't want to cook down too much now. We don't want the cream to break out. Vegetable puree has cellulose. It just does. Doesn't sound appetizing, but it's there. Cellulose has a thickening property to it. Now, parsnips and carrots have more cellulose than leeks, which are next to none. Fennel is somewhere closer to leeks and celery than carrots. So you may need to use a slurry to thicken the soup at the end, but that's something that no cook can know ahead of time. Because it's even from parsnip to parsnip and carrot to carrot, how much cellulose is in there? Nobody knows. So, but that's a puree soup. Now it can be garnished with, now this would be interesting, you could take very thin juliennes or ribbons of parsnips, deep fry them so they turn brown. They have a really nice flavor and they have a fun crunch. And a fun crunch and a good flavor that is kind of roasty because of the frying is a flavor and texture contrast to this very smooth, white puree soup. Fried parsnips are fun. It's a waste of fat, but they're fun. Veloute soups. Veloute is a kind of a sauce. It is a stock thickened with a roux. So, chicken stock, beef stock. Beef veloute sounds weird. It just always has. Chicken and fish veloutes make much more sense to me. Pork veloute makes more sense to me. You can go crazy with the different kinds of garnishes you can make with that. And they can also be pureed. Even though the veloutes, they can be pureed and strained so they're smooth. They can be garnished with stuff. You can get into your chowders, which are always chunky. And actually, Jeremiah Tower did a book on chowder. I think he had 50 different recipes. Chowder is, I think it is a distinctly American art form, even if not an American invention. There's also cream soups, and then I'm flipping to get to, specialty soups and thickened bouillons. So here's the potage à beurre and the mulligatawny and just all different kinds of things. And there's a whole bunch of soups in here. The international repertoire, borscht, kakaliki soup. Kakaliki soup, funny name, good soup. Mutton broth. So, and this is interesting. I just happened to notice oyster soup with okra, parentheses, USA. Yes, absolutely. So,
let's take a moment out for a word from Jake about his Tasting Anarchy podcast.
Hey everyone, Jake here, host of the Tasting Anarchy podcast. Join my co-host Mason and I each week as we explore the world of wine and alcohol through a Liberty lens. You can find us on all your major podcatchers, tastinganarchy.com or Tasting Anarchy on Twitter. Tasting Anarchy, your wine and liberty podcast. Find out how much government is in your drink.
So two diversions, and I think I'm going to call it a day here. So when I was at the restaurant in Tallahassee, we used fresh artichokes. Now, cleaning fresh artichokes is a task all by itself. And artichokes, the ones we bought, came 24 to a case. And we left the stem on because there's something to eat inside the stem once you clean all the fibers away. Now, my sous chef at the time got very, very good at cleaning artichokes. So I'm going to brag on him. He won't hear this, probably. But he did a case of 24 artichokes cleaned and in the water in half an hour. Now, if you've ever cleaned an artichoke, that's some hauling. Now, the thing about artichokes is, fine, you have these artichoke hearts, and that's fantastic. There's lots of things to do with that. You have a lot of trim. What do you do with it? The answer is you make soup. Now, it isn't a overly pretty color. It's kind of an olive drab color. It was a cream soup, I can tell you that. Lots of onions and garlic, and all of this artichoke trim gets sweated down, then stock on top of that, and then cooked, and then if you have one of the, a little teeny tiny home version of those immersion mixers or burr mixers, it probably won't stand. You might be able to do it in a blender. We did it with a giant burr mixer. Puree it all, strain it, and the fibers, holy moly, let me tell you, the fibers, you get lots and lots of fibers. But when you finally get the soup out of this, bring it back to the boil, add some cream to it, thicken it with a little bit of cornstarch if necessary, because there's all that cellulose. Now, garnish it with some of the artichoke hearts. You got a nice soup. And if you're in a restaurant, and this is how restaurants make money, is by they sell soup. The other thing, oyster soup, is we did an app called Fried Oysters. We buy oysters in a tub called Selects. And if you're lucky, at the end of your oyster bucket, you're going to get a pint or so of really fabulous oyster liquor. What do you do with that? If you go through two or three or four or five or six of these bins every couple of days, you're getting a gallon of oyster liquor. Well, sounds like soup to me, and it was. So, you know what? I never did okra with it, though. I should have. That was a good idea. So, oyster soup, soups. So from a home use version, home people, and I do this, I set out to make a soup. Is chili a soup or a meal? I don't know. I set out to make chili. I set out to make soup. Sometimes I look around what I've got, and especially in a restaurant, what can I do? And think about it at home. What can you do with the stuff in the cooler? You've got all these leftovers. I hope you dated them and labeled them. And if they're not in the back and all green and fuzzy and they still smell good, what kind of soup can be made? You might need to make an ingredient. You might need to make a stock to turn that into soup, but that's okay. It's in with the price of everything these days, conserving as much ingredient as possible and leftovers as possible to put into another soup is a really good idea. Now, let me just, this isn't an escoffier anywhere. If you happen to have, and I know this sounds just ridiculous, who would do this? If you happen to have leftover biscuits from Sunday brunch, freeze them. If no one ate them, freeze them anyway and tell them they're gone. If you either, you can chop them up or dry them out a little bit, but leftover biscuits makes a spectacular thickening agent for a soup. So if you're sweating some veggies, some onions and some parsnips and some fennel and some carrots, and you want those things in there, you've cut them so they're going to be the garnish in the soup, but you want this to be kind of thick because you have a stock, chop up those pieces of biscuit or use a box grater and shred them a little bit into little bits like flour, because fundamentally that's what you've got. You've got flour and butter, and so the butter is going to add a richness to this finished soup, but the velvety creaminess you get from a biscuit as a thickener exceeds the velvety creaminess from a roux every single day. And it's one heck of a trick. It's really worth doing. So, all right, I'm going to stop there because there are some more details, and I think I'll cover the nitty-gritty. We'll get into the nitty-gritty of soups on the next one of these, and then chapter 4 is hors d'oeuvre, and there's something to that. And there's definitely something to cover, but so remember, we're talking about service at the king and royalty, and everyone's there, and so you have, it's a magnificent presentation. It really is awesome. I think we have to do a little bit about hors d'oeuvre. We're probably going to go omit the chapter on eggs. I'll take a look at it and see. We'll talk about maybe poaching eggs, because that's fun to do, and it's tasty. And then we'll work our way into fish, and then we'll get into meats, and then it gets serious.
All right, folks, that's going to do it. Springtime is a good reason to stock up on wines. Summer is coming, and warm days need a good cold blush or a fruity white wine. Check out the selection at my affiliate, California Wine Club. Use my link, culinarylibertarian.com/wine, to subscribe to the internet's number one wine club. Thank you for listening. I appreciate you being here. Thanks also to my Patreon supporters. Support the show with a membership to Patreon or a donation in cash or crypto. Find all the ways I have for support on the support page, culinarylibertarian.com/support. Please rate and review the show on your favorite podcatcher. Have a good week, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian Podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.